Donald Trump made many, many pronouncements on the campaign trail, one of which was this.
We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement and stop. Unbelievable. And stop all payments of the United States tax dollars to UN global warming programs.
While he can't cancel the Paris Agreement, he can and has walked away from it, with an executive order this week substantially erasing President Obama's climate legacy and signaling to the world that the U.S. is not going to meet its carbon emissions goals.
With today's executive action, I am taking historic steps to lift the restrictions on American energy, to reverse government intrusion, and to cancel job-killing regulations.
The president's order calls for EPA Chief Scott Pruitt to dismantle the Clean Power Plan. That's the set of rules regulating energy plants powered by fossil fuels, a plan put in place by the Obama administration following the 2015 Paris talks. Even with the plan in place, we were going to have a hard time meeting the Paris goals. Without the plan, forget about it. As it is, the Clean Power Plan never actually went into effect. It's been held up in the courts for more than a year. And if Pruitt does annul the regulations, the law requires another set of rules to be put in their place. Repeal and replace. That shouldn't be a problem. So what exactly was agreed upon in Paris? Obama declared it, quote, a turning point for the world. The media hailed a landmark achievement. But many climate change activists like Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org, decried the deal as woefully insufficient. James Hansen, the NASA scientist who drew attention to climate change in 1988, called the deal a fraud. To find clarity among the conflicting commentary, Brooke in 2015 spoke with two of our favorite climate change journalists, Andrew Revkin, who writes the Dot Earth blog in the New York Times, and Jonathan Katz, who covered the talks in Paris for the New Republic. Here's Brooke.
So what does this deal do and not do? Andy?
Remember, this is just the thumbnail sketch of a fuller deal that would be adopted by 2020. It basically creates a binding process by which countries individually pledge to change course from business as usual on carbon dioxide and these other gases and on deforestation. And the rich countries have firmed up a little bit the language by which they will create a fund that will compensate poor ones for climate impacts that are the result of these changes in the system from the warming that's happening. What they've created is an architecture for getting everybody, in a very nudgy Cass Sunstein way, getting everybody to move forward. And one of the promising things going forward, and this relates to the media too, and not just the conventional journalist media, but the transparency that's imposable on the world now in terms of tracking deforestation rates or how much coal is being used is very promising because it makes this more doable without having kind of a global carbon police. One demonstration of this was that just ahead of these talks, China came out with much more honest numbers for its coal-based emissions. And I think that shows you that it's just getting harder to cheat. Think about Volkswagen. You know, they cheated for 4 or 5 years, but the revelations that led to that came from independent analysis. You know, that's doable on a global scale now more and more, and also with the remote sensing satellites in terms of things like deforestation. So there is a promising prospect of having progress without a carbon police.
So this deal calls for or firmly suggests that 187 countries pledge to cut their emissions to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, which people say is impossible to achieve. So is this purely symbolic?
This is something that people were talking about a lot. The problem was we're already on track to go past that based on the emissions that have already been emitted. And when you add up the individual countries' pledges that are the voluntary part of this agreement, we're going to blow right past that really quickly. So what's the point of even having that language? But the main thing that people were saying that was positive was if at the very least we have this as a goal, then countries can at least shame one another, or when they're talking to each other in bilateral negotiations, they can say, hey, look, you agreed to this and we agreed to this and let's both go for this together. And that maybe in some way through some kind of international body English, we might be able to lean closer to that target.
There are so many fantastical aspects to this whole process. We are not even remotely engaged in the kind of energy push that you would need to decarbonize a world that's still more than 80% dependent on fossil fuels, where the United States, the nuclear power plants that we have are all old and we're not building or designing new ones, where the demand for energy that goes with progress is fundamental and not subject to diplomacy. I wrote a couple of years ago about a knife fight between two families in the Himalayas over firewood. And they need any kind of energy more than they need firewood because they've already depleted the trees of all the low-hanging branches.
So how is this a turning point?
Because the process has acknowledged this. It used to be literally a magical thinking process. Kyoto Protocol was magical thinking.
In what way?
It had binding targets and tables, but it had all kinds of loopholes. We now acknowledge that we can't solve this the way we thought we could. You know, this was the first time since covering this since 1988 when I saw, not in the treaty diplomacy, but at least in the ancillary announcements, commitments to basic research and development to say we need more science here too. We don't know how to do this. And those were all, like, to me, tweaks in the right direction.
Now, one reason the agreement isn't legally binding is because the U.S. got everyone to agree to change the word shall to should, because requiring accountability could allow the Republicans in Congress to kill it. It seems like these climate deniers yield a disproportionate influence over global climate change policy. Jonathan, did this come up in Paris?
Yeah, it was really surprising to me. Basically, the head European climate change negotiator from Spain, Miguel Arias Cañete, gets up and he's answering a question about why this agreement can't actually require cuts to emissions or actually require that the developed countries, the rich countries, pay money that they have said or at least vaguely implied that they would pay to help developing countries and seriously poor countries deal with the effects of climate change. And his answer was Congress, the Senate, and the Republican Party. Big Spanish dude with a white beard who's standing up in front of the room and blaming the Republicans for this. And I have a feeling that to a certain extent that might have been a little bit oversold. U.S. presidential administrations in general don't really need any help not wanting to be bound to international accountability. But nonetheless, the specter of the Republican Party was haunting Europe across this entire conversation.
I wrote a piece earlier in the year called No Red and Blue States When It Comes to Renewable Energy Progress and Even Regulating Carbon Dioxide as a Pollutant. This was based on Yale and Utah State study. State by state, they came out with a map of the country's attitudes on putting more federal investment into renewable energy research and also into restricting carbon dioxide from power plants as a pollutant. And there's no red and blue. That whole map that we live by in political reporting goes away when you ask those kinds of questions. By making it all about your views on the severity of global warming, that enables the polarization of an issue where there actually, behind the scenes, is a lot of common thinking.
So what about the polls that suggest a large percentage of Americans don't believe in climate change?
Those polls, don't get me started. The only poll that matters, both in terms of politics and, you know, how many people are reading these stories that we're all writing, are how salient is global warming to you? The ones that just ask you, what worries you? Pause. Almost everybody fills in that blank with the economy, healthcare, you know, getting my kids to school. And climate change perpetually, since the 80s, has not budged really in its salience.
There is something really interesting, though, and you've probably seen the same thing, Andy, is that there is a shift that is going on even in the rhetoric of very senior people in the Republican Party. Comments that Jeb Bush has made about climate change, even comments that people like Charles Koch have made about climate change. There's more of an appreciation that it's real, and they're trying to find other ways to talk about it, basically saying, well, it's not really going to be catastrophic, or yeah, it's real and people are affecting it, but that's not the whole story, or the problems that we're seeing, we're really not going to see until so far down the road that we don't even need to talk about it now. So the upshot for them is still the same, which is basically don't touch the oil industry, but they're starting to have to admit that reality is reality. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see the way that debate changes even over the course of the coming presidential election and after that.
So what's the story that isn't getting told here?
The thing that's disappointed me the most about seeing the way that this thing has been covered is the way that this is still treated by most of the press in the United States as being this sort of esoteric side issue. I mean, at the Republican debate in Las Vegas, there wasn't a single question asked on CNN about the Paris talks. The only time that climate change came up at all was for John Kasich of Ohio to make fun of the fact that there was a climate summit at all. He said that it should have been canceled, and basically the 33,000 people who came to Paris to talk about this thing should have all switched expertise and started talking about ISIS instead. And then I think at some point Donald Trump made some kind of weird, dumb joke about it. And that was it. When this is our world, this is the central core issue that people in my generation, I'm 35 years old, for the rest of our lives, this is going to be the most important stuff that we deal with. And yet the coverage just sort of assumes that it's like, oh yeah, it's this boring thing and people went to Paris and they ate baguettes and they had this conversation and now let's talk about ISIS. When really, compared to climate change, ISIS is the sideshow. It's really frustrating to me. I just wish that more people who were paying attention to this would begin to understand that.
The media still are essentially reflecting how we as a species, H. sapiens, the sapient aspect of us is still largely built around the here and now, meaning things that are local to you. I hope that artists and psychologists and everyone, along with engineers and political science students, is thinking, I have a role to play here, and seeing if there's a way for us to integrate information in ways that give us a longer view of how we act, what we invest in. How can we build a reader who is able to step back and capture the big picture? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is there.
You said we have to build a news consumer that can handle this stuff, but that's just not how the business works.
I have good news and bad news, and they're the same thing, which is that this is becoming breaking news. This is happening in real time. For instance, I just came back from the Caribbean. I was out there talking to farmers, and the farmers are reeling right now from a really, really bad drought. I was in Cuba a couple weeks before that, and the same thing was happening in Cuba as well. And there's nothing more local. There's no more local news than farmers not being able to grow crops because the weather's changed. You can actually go out to places, and you can see the effects on people's day-to-day lives. And the good and bad news for journalists is that that's going to make telling these stories a lot easier, and it's also going to shift the needle in terms of what public opinion is.
Well, thank God for that. Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Katz covered the talks in Paris for The New Republic. And Andrew, thank you very much.
It was great to be with you again.
Andrew Revkin writes the New York Times blog, .earth.
Thanks for listening to this On the Media Podcast Extra. Did you sign up for our newsletter yet? If you do it in the next 2 weeks, you will be automatically entered to win one of Brooke's hand-crocheted hats. Go to onthemedia.org and sign up now. And one more thing, On the Media is now available on Spotify. I'm Bob Garfield.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.